From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Jane Curtin started out as a Boston debutante, but wound up in the original cast of Saturday Night Live. Since then, she's gone on to co-star in the CBS series Kate and Ally. On this edition of Fresh Air, Jane Curtin tells us about starring in parodies of sitcoms and starring in The Real Thing. Cyndi Lauper and the Bangles have had hits with songs written by Jules Shear. His own recordings of his songs haven't gone much beyond a cult audience. Today, Shear talks about his songs, his singing, and his new band, Reckless Sleepers. Performer-in-residence Harry Connick Jr. plays a couple of Duke Ellington songs, and critic-at-large Laurie Stone looks at how women are portrayed in three new TV sitcoms. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Her early fans remember her as the mother of the Conehead family and as an anchor of Weekend Update. Jane Curtin was an original cast member of Saturday Night Live and stayed with the show for 5 years. She was the only original cast member to end up back on TV in a weekly sitcom. Curtin co-stars with Susan St. James in Kate and Ally. It's a family sitcom about an alternative family. Curtin and St. James play single mothers who pool their resources by sharing a house together with their children. Jane Curtin won 2 Emmys for her work on Kate and Ally. Here's a clip from an episode in which Ally loses her wallet. She finds herself in the middle of Manhattan, penniless and shabbily dressed in her house cleaning clothes. To her horror, each time she politely approaches a stranger to borrow train fare, the person inches back, thinking Ally is a homeless street person.
Taxi!
Wait a minute. I have that sweater. She must be a nice person. We have the same clothes.
Taxi!
Excuse me. Hi. I have that sweater. Curciati, $175 less if you get it on sale. See, I'm a normal person. Can I have a dollar?
Look, get away from me before I call a policeman.
It won't do you any good. I've been looking for a policeman for 15 blocks.
Why don't you people get jobs and support yourself like everybody else?
Cabbie! What do you mean, you people? I'm not you people. I'm your people. And that sweater looks better on me.
Jane Curtin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
I have to say, I was both surprised and delighted after seeing you do parodies of sitcoms for so long on Saturday Night Live, actually star in a sitcom yourself. You must have had a set of ground rules for what kind of sitcom you wanted to do.
No. I didn't. I took some time off from regular work, you know, series kind of work after Saturday Night, just because it was so exhausting. And television is frightening enough, so that, you know, if you go in with a set of ground rules, you're pretty much limiting yourself to the other people who are available, and meaning writers and directors and producers who also have ideas. And when I read the script of Kate and Ally, the first script of Kate and Ally called Two Mommies, I thought, no way I'm going to do this.
What didn't you like about it?
It was called Two Mommies. And right. There was no way to tell the difference between either of the characters, and it just didn't really interest me. But, you know, you work because you like to work, and you hope everything can turn out to be something that you're proud of.
Did you play a part in making the series more of what you wanted it to be?
Only in the sense of what I brought to the character.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get involved in the planning of it, no.
So you like the series now, or do you still not like it? I can't tell from
what
you're saying.
I like it turned itself into and was turned into something that I'm very proud of. A lot of that had to do with the people who were in charge of doing that, who were in charge of creating a situation where it would be appealing to audiences, and it would also be relevant and fun.
Do you think your character has changed over the years?
Oh, yeah.
What are some of the changes you've seen Ally go through?
Well, I mean, Ally was a neurotic mess when the show started. It was a woman who just couldn't function at all. And now, after 5 years, the character has gotten her degree and is capable of holding down a job, and a relationship.
You are a mother. You have one daughter, is mm-hmm. that right? Does it ever feel really absurd to be spending all the time on the set with your television family away from your actual family?
Well, I've been really lucky in the sense that up until this year, we have a new regime now, and so our hours are longer. But up until this year, we really saw our own families more than we saw our TV family. We do the show in 3.5 days.
Oh.
So,
it's almost like a part-time job.
It was. It was like banker's hours. It was just terrific. And it was terrific because my daughter was very young, and she was in preschool, and you really don't want to miss that time. But you do get attached to the kids on the show as well. I mean, I feel very close to those two.
Do you feel motherly towards the two television children that you have?
No. I feel more like their friend, probably because their mothers have been on the set too. But I feel more like a peer. Maybe it's because I'm immature. I don't know.
What are the plans for Kate and Allie now? It's not on the air at this moment.
No, it's not on the air, but we are in production, and I think we're being held as a designated hitter. If the series that they have on for the new season don't work, then they need shows in production that can replace them once they're taken off the air. And that's what our function is right now.
What changes in the storyline will there be in the new season?
Oh, many changes in the storyline. I got married. Mm-hmm. And Bob Barsky and I move uptown and get a new apartment. And Kate is down in the village all by herself. Her daughter's at school, and she needs another roommate to afford the apartment. Can't find one suitable. So Bob gets a job in Washington and has to commute. So while he's commuting, Kate moves in with me.
So now he can make irregular appearances.
Yeah.
he could be out of town on some episodes and back home for others.
Yeah.
What kinds of television sitcoms did you like, and what kinds did you hate when you were growing up watching TV?
I like the silly ones. I like Lucy and the Joan B. Davis show. I Married Joan. The ones that were just totally, without any basis of reality.
You've just named two where the women were complete idiots, basically.
But they were fun. Uh-huh. I mean, and women were portrayed as idiots in the 50s. The ones I didn't like, the family ones, the sweet ones, they sort of made my teeth itch.
Like which ones? Donna Reed?
Yeah, I was going to say that. Father Knows Best.
Wait, didn't you play Donna Reed once on Saturday Night
Yeah.
Live? Yeah.
And I mean, I never met Donna Reed, and I'm sure she was a lovely person, but I just never believed those shows. It was easier to believe Lucy than it was to believe Donna Reed.
Uh-huh. Oh, Jen Curtin is my guest, and she stars in Kate and Allie, which will be back soon on television. And she's also an alumnus of Saturday Night Live. You've played so many housewives between the housewives you played on parodies of sitcoms on Saturday Night Live and the almost housewife that you play on Kate and Allie. Did you ever, when you were growing up, consider that as a life that you would choose for yourself?
No, I was very career-oriented. I definitely wanted to have a career because my mother kept telling my sister and me that it was very important that we have something to do before we get married, if we get married. And so I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what it was exactly that I wanted to do. But I knew I was going to do something and have some sort of job. I didn't want to just get married.
Mm-hmm.
It was too frightening.
I've seen you play so many roles, but I know very little about what your real background is. You went to Catholic boarding school, is
mm-hmm.
that right?
Yeah.
And
That's why I have knobs on my knees.
Do you really? From
yeah, from dropping to the floor at a moment's notice.
Were you a debutante also?
Yes.
Now,
can't you tell?
Well, you know, you just never know. I mean,
oh my God, I just. You could tell by the way I walked and the way I presented myself.
So
years of training.
You had a coming out party?
Absolutely.
Did you want one, or
no.
Was that just de rigueur?
It was, well, my sister came out, and we had the dress.
So you couldn't let it go to waste.
No.
So
I didn't have a date for my coming out party.
Really?
I brought my cousin.
Well, did you try to tell your parents you didn't want one?
Well, I it was with about 13 girls that came out at the same time. We all went to dancing school together.
Uh-huh. But ballet or jazz?
Ballroom.
Dance? Ballroom, excuse me. I should have realized that, I guess. So anyway, so you were with other girls and they were having their coming out party?
Yes, it seemed like the natural progression from the dancing school to the coming out party and presented to the Cardinal in Boston.
Wow. Mm. Now, how did you gravitate to comedy?
Could have been my background. I came from a family of funny women. My mother is very funny. Her sisters are very funny. My grandmother was very funny. And we laughed a lot in my house.
Well, how did you know you had a gift for it, besides making people laugh around the dinner table?
I didn't until I got my first job.
Which was doing what?
The Proposition in Boston. It was an improvisational group.
How did you learn that Saturday Night Live was having auditions?
My agent told me.
Mm-hmm.
And every actor in New York auditioned for that show, even though no one knew what it was. But they must have had 3 months of auditions for that show. I would bump into everybody I knew there.
What did you do for your audition?
Well, the first audition I had, I improvised with two friends of mine, and Bob Barsky, Sam Fried, who plays my husband on the show, was one of the guys I improvised with. And I was called back, and they said that they just wanted to talk to me at the callback. So I went into this room with all of the writers from Saturday Night who were on staff at that point, and Gilda had been hired, and I think Lorraine was there. And I went into the room, and there was a chair set up in front of all of these people. And I went in and I sat down, expecting them to start talking to me. And they said, "What have you prepared?" And I said, "Nothing. I was told that you wanted to talk." And they said, no, we wanted you to come back with a 2-minute piece that you wrote." And I said, well, and they said, "Well, if you want to come back another day, that'll be fine." And as I was walking out, I realized that I had written my appointment on a piece that I had written for an audition tape for a network. And I had a sketch in my pocketbook. So I pulled it out and said, "No, wait, I have something." And they said, "Well, fine, you can do it." And I said, "Well, it's two women." And they said, "Well, Gilda will read with you." And I said, "Okay." And Gilda said, "What do you want me to do?" And I said, "Just do exactly what I do." And I guess they liked the piece.
You know, on Saturday Night Live, I always used to love when you would host parodies of talk shows. Being in the biz myself, So I thought I'd just play a short clip here of one of the shows that you did. And this is one called Heavy Sarcasm. This is Jane Curtin.
Good evening and welcome to Heavy Sarcasm. I'm your host, Joan Face. As you may know, this is our last show tonight, but we've put together a really fascinating program. I'm sure you'll love it. My first guest is a great, great writer, Nigel Quist, whom I know you're all big fans of, as who wouldn't be?
Thank you, Joan. Being on your show is a real thrill for me. It's certainly a must for any author promoting a book.
Well, your career is really taking off. I hear you've just written a book about Bruce and Christy Jenner. That must have been a really rewarding experience.
Yes, it really was really interesting to write. I mean, they are a wonderful couple.
Well, I'm sure your book will sell millions.
I hope so. After all, what could be more important than Bruce and Christy Jenner?
That's Jane Curtin with Eric Idle. Was sarcasm a trademark of yours?
I guess so. Yeah, people used to think I was extremely sarcastic.
Did you write that sketch?
No, I didn't. I didn't write on the show.
You never wrote on the show?
No. It was actually, to get involved in that. See, I was married when I was doing Saturday Night. I'd still married. And I had a home life. And if you didn't have a home life, then you could write on the show. But
sleep over in the office overnight,
exactly.
And keep
people,
writing.
People had bunk beds in their offices, and I couldn't do that.
So you must have led a pretty different social life from the rest of people on the show, too.
Well, none of us had any social life.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your life and your work, but first we're going to take a short break. Jane Curtin is my guest, co-star of Kate and Ally, which is scheduled to return sometime this season on CBS TV. She's also an alumnus of Saturday Night Live, where she performed for 5 years. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Jane Curtin is my guest. You were, you told us you had been a debutante, and in some ways you were the closest to establishment-looking of the people on the show.
I think white bread is the term that they use.
Well, how do you feel that you used that in your work, and did you ever feel like it was used against you?
No, I mean, it's always been an advantage to have a white bread look, especially if you're prone to comedy. And prior to Saturday Night, I had been doing mostly character work in improvisation and some plays, but I started making a living, actually being able to pay the rent by doing commercials. And that had a lot to do with the fact that I was not offensive looking or strange looking.
What's another thing you've done, both the real version of and the parody version of?
Mm-hmm.
It's commercial. What kind of commercials did you used to do?
Oh God, I did more Lysol commercials.
Did
than
you
anybody.
Really?
Yeah, I think they thought I frightened germs or something.
Oh, so were you convincing? I guess you must have been
tremendously convincing. I bought Lysol. I convinced myself.
Did you have favorite characters that you played in Saturday Night Live?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I played at the fifth year of the show, a woman named Iris, a great big fat woman, real tough broad. I liked her, and I love Mrs. Loebner.
How come?
Just because she was so stupid.
Who did you pattern her on? What did you do to form her?
Oh, there was a woman that I used to see walking my dog, and my dog would play with her dog. And she just, you could say, you know, there's the threat of a nuclear attack, and she'd go, I didn't know. She was hysterical. That was Mrs. Loebner.
Did you enjoy the Conehead series, the Conehead family?
No, I just didn't like the cone. I mean, if I could have done the Coneheads without the cone, without the spirit gum. I lost a lot of hair.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when they had plenty of time to put the cone on, but not much time to take the cone off. So they'd rip it off my head. It hurt so much.
What about Point Counterpoint?
Point Counterpoint was a lot of fun, because working with Danny is a lot of fun.
Yeah, how about the part where he'd say, Jane, you slut? And everybody around the country was saying to people, Jane, you slut.
I know, and they still do.
They still do. Did you like that?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Well, I like doing it.
Yeah,
I don't
yeah.
necessarily like having a catchphrase, but Point Counterpoint was a lot of fun.
The catchphrase thing is an interesting thing, because some of the people on Saturday Night Live had a catchphrase and others didn't. You didn't, really, except for that one that was said about you.
Yeah.
But it gives you, like, a handle for people to recognize you. On the other hand, it kind of pegs you into something you're forced into doing week after week.
I know. It's a nightmare.
Did you choose to not have a catchphrase? Was that a conscious choice?
No, I just didn't have one. I couldn't think of one.
Okay. So you never wrote your own material. It seems to me like it was probably the kind of show where people would try to save their best ideas for sketches that they could appear in themselves. Did you have to, like, lobby hard to get the kinds of parts that you wanted?
The first year of the show, I was practically non-existent because they really didn't quite know what to do with me. And then when Chevy left and I started doing Update, it became easier going to work. There were shows in the first year that I was only in the tag. I was only in the good nights. Because if they had an actress on the show, then I would naturally lose pieces because they would have the actress doing the straight parts. And that's all that they could figure out for me to do until they started letting me do character work towards the end of the second year and the rest of the time that we were on the air.
Did that also change for you when Chevy Chase left and you took over Weekend Update?
Well, Update was the thing that made me more comfortable in the sense that I knew I had something to do every week when I came in. And Gild and Lorraine still had to fight. But the three of us fought a lot for material the first year of the show.
The three women fought a lot?
Mm-hmm.
It must have been hard because on the one hand you probably felt a certain solidarity, being the three women on the show. On the other hand, you had to compete for the roles that were available.
Well, we wouldn't. It was interesting because Lorne Michaels, the producer, at one point, well, Gilda Lorraine and I shared a dressing room. It was a very small space, and it was difficult for us because we liked each other so much. And he said that he wanted us to fight more to compete more with each other, and that was not really in our natures. And also, there were pieces. It was very rare that there was a piece that the three of us all wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. There's a book. I don't know what you think of this book called Saturday Night by Doug Hill and Jeff Weingrad. And I don't know what your impression of the book is, but in the book it says that of all the women on the show, that you were the least willing to laugh off John Belushi's sexism. Without getting into Belushi in particular, did you looking back? Do you feel that? You were the woman most anxious in taking a stand against sexism on the show, and what did that mean exactly?
It was impossible to take a stand against it. I mean,
well, to refuse to participate, I guess. Yeah.
It was there was a very misogynistic attitude on Saturday night, and it was the first time I had ever been exposed to anything like that, and it was a bit shocking. I thought this was, you know, we were in a fairly enlightened age, and yet we were dealing with people who were very threatened by women. And there were times when people would refuse to do a piece because it was written by a woman, which is absurd.
Is this still part of the period where you had to prove that, yes, women could be funny?
Yeah, yeah. It was... I was thrown by it, actually.
Were there sketches that you refused to do because you thought that they were too sexist?
No. No. I mean, when you're doing satire, there are very few things that you won't do, especially if they're funny. And we had people who were establishing the guidelines from the network, so we were pretty safe. But that was satire. And the sexism on the show was real.
So, in other words, the sexism to you is what happened behind the scenes, not on the air.
Yeah. Yeah. And the sexism was translated in a lot of the pieces, but it was easier to do it on stage, to do those pieces on stage where women were put in a bad light, so to speak. Because it was going on in the world, clearly. I mean, I was seeing it in my workplace. So, I mean, better show it to the world and think that, yes, we still have a long way to go.
One sketch that you had to do in when you were doing Weekend Update, there was one time where you had to rip open your blouse, and it was something to the effect of
try these on for size, Connie Chung.
Yeah. Yeah, and about it was how I thought responsible journalism... was what this was about, not sex appeal. Do you feel like you put a different spin on that when you ripped your blouse open than what was actually written for you?
That was written for me.
Uh-huh.
The action was written for me as well.
But, I mean, did you feel like you did it in the same spirit it was written, or that you did it in a slightly different spirit?
Well, they had written it according to the character that I had been playing for a while, the very rigid, very uptight Weekend Update lady. And it seemed like a natural progression for her to be driven to the point where she would have to do something like that.
Did you feel like you watched a lot of people being changed by fame and success on the show as the show became more popular? I mean, let's face it, you were dealing with a lot of, like, young people who were very talented with big egos. And that's it's a very combustible combination.
It was a tremendous education. And because I'm basically a cautious person, I don't jump into things very quickly, especially when it comes to affecting my life. But I would watch other people grab the opportunities that were given to them, as most people would, and saw how they reacted, and ultimately how the press reacts to you. They create the monster, and then they destroy the monster, and it's a horrible thing to watch.
Are you still in touch with the people who you worked with on Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, some of them, yeah.
Do you still watch the show?
No.
Why not?
I don't stay up that late anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm up at 6:30 in the morning making tuna sandwiches and stuffing the My Little Pony lunchbox.
When you get recognized in the streets, you get a very different reaction now when people recognize you as Allie from Kate and Allie than when they recognized you as Jane Curtin from Saturday Night Live.
Oh, totally different. They were afraid of me. I would go out and walk my dog and clear the streets when I was on Saturday Night. And on Kate and Allie, it's a much more accessible character and a friendlier character and a sympathetic character. So people just sort of walk by and go, Allie. And that's nice. That's nice.
Of course, that's not really you at all, though.
No, I'm the woman that clears the streets when I go out and walk my dog.
Why were people afraid of you?
I think they were afraid of the humor. They were afraid of the style of humor that we did on the show. And at parties, people would be very defensive. And I actually, someone started to shake when I walked by them, which was very unnerving. I don't know whether he thought I was going to hit him or attack him in some way. I don't know. And there was a larger-than-life persona that was attached to all of us. So it was very unnerving.
What are your plans for the future? Will you be doing movies as well as TV now?
I don't know. I like television. It's it's very facile, and I'm more of a spontaneous performer than I am. I don't give me 3 weeks to study a script, and I'll destroy it. But if you let me do it in a week, it'll be fine. So that's why television is good for me. I don't know what I'll end up doing. We'll see.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank
this
you so
fun.
Much. I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for coming.
Okay.
My guest has been Jane Curtin, the star of Kate and Allie, which will probably be back sometime in the middle of the season on CBS TV. And she's also an alumnus of the original cast of Saturday Night Live. And she's going to appear in an NBC movie this season with Dabney Coleman. It's called Sooner or Later. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with John Carpenter, who directed the horror films Halloween, Christine, and Escape from New York. His new film, They Live, is about aliens disguised as humans who take over the planet. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Other people have had more luck with Jules Shear's songs than he has. His song All Through the Night was a hit for Cyndi Lauper, and the Bangles had a hit with his song If She Knew What She Wants. Coming up, Jules Shear talks about his music, as performed by others, and by Shear himself with his new band Reckless Sleepers. New Orleans pianist Harry Connick Jr. continues his tenure as Fresh Air's performer in residence. Today he plays a couple of Duke Ellington songs. And critic at large Laurie Stone compares how women are portrayed in the movies and on TV. Laurie says the difference may have something to do with the movie audience being mostly male and the TV audience mostly female. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Occupational Safety and Health Administration officials today said they plan to fine the John Morrell Meatpacking Company more than $4 million, the biggest fine in OSHA history, for willfully ignoring an epidemic of worker injuries. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reports.
Agency officials say the meat industry has the worst worker injury record in the nation, and they said the John Morrell Company has the worst record in the industry. According to agency officials, more than 40% of the workers, almost 900 of them, were seriously injured at just one Morrell factory during just the past year. The injuries are caused by doing the same hand motions over and over again. Some workers have been permanently disabled. And OSHA officials said company executives knew hundreds of workers were getting injured as early as 1984, but refused to take action to protect them. Agency officials also charged today that Morrell executives aggravated employees' injuries by forcing them to go back to work only a couple days after getting surgery on the injuries. It's the first time OSHA has cited a company for bad medical care. The Morrell Company's chief executive, Milton Schloss, denounced OSHA's action as grossly unfair and totally unjustified. He said the company has been working hard in recent months to improve plant safety, and he said the company will fight the agency fine in court. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Washington.
The federal government is banning the game known as lawn darts. The Consumer Product Safety Commission says that in the last 10 years, more than 7,000 people have been injured while playing the game. At least 3 children have died as a result of lawn dart injuries. In a speech today in Los Angeles, President Reagan called his final year in office one of the most crucial and significant in the history of American foreign policy. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
Ronald Reagan told the Los Angeles World Affairs Council that the lights of freedom are going on all over the world. He said that the democratic and economic reforms in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe and the growth of democracy in Latin America and throughout the world were a direct result of a shift in American foreign policy during his administration.
We now hold that containment is no longer enough, that ours is a forward strategy for freedom.
The president said this strategy grows from a reaffirmation of the uniqueness and the moral superiority of Western values, such as freedom, democracy, and the rule of law. And these values, he said, point to a foreign policy agenda for the future, including continued support of the Nicaraguan Contras and research, development, and testing of strategic defense initiatives. Mr. Reagan also called for renewed efforts to reduce nuclear arms and eliminate chemical weapons, saying he has called for an international conference against the use of chemical weapons to meet in Paris in January. In Los Angeles, I'm Ina Jaffe reporting.
Members of a U.S. organization aiding the Nicaraguan Contra rebels regularly brief the FBI and U.S. military intelligence about their activities. That today from government documents released. 7 leaders of the organization are under indictment for violating the U.S. Neutrality Act by arming the Contras. Their defense lawyers say the defendants are innocent because they were working with the Reagan administration. Latin American leaders meeting in Punta del Este, Uruguay, today said the United States and other industrialized countries must establish a new way of relating to Latin American governments. After interrogating 13 Arab suspects arrested earlier in the week, West German officials say the group planned to stage terrorist attacks in another country. The country was not named. Israeli and American interests were reportedly the targets. The group is said to have links to radical Palestinians who want to prevent PLO leader Yasser Arafat from making peace overtures to Israel. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 9 points to close at 2149.89. Advances led decline 6-5 on volume of 146 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 13 cents. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The composition is Duke Ellington's Caravan, played by our performer-in-residence, Harry Connick Jr. Connick was born and raised in New Orleans and has been performing for about 16 years, ever since he was five. He grew up surrounded by many different musical styles, rhythm and blues, Dixieland, and jazz. Columbia Records has just released his second album, called 20. Today on Fresh Air, Connick pays tribute to Ellington.
Duke Ellington had an incredible concept for playing the piano. He understood harmony like no one else. He understood rhythm like no one else. And particularly understood the blues like no one else. Duke Ellington could play the blues and avoid all cliches, and he could do it with nobility and elegance, just like the man he was. He was an incredibly poised and elegant man, and the way he played piano demonstrated how incredible a musician and incredible a man he was. And I can just see Duke Ellington sitting in his penthouse New York apartment singing this tune. You ain't been blue No You have not been blue till you've had that mood indigo. That feeling goes stealing down to my shoes, and I sit and sigh, go long. Always get that mood indigo since my baby said goodbye. In the evening when lights are low, I'm so lonesome I could cry. There's nobody who cares about me. I'm just as blue can be. When I get that mood indigo, I could lay me down and die. Mood Indigo. Here's a tune that Duke would perform to get everybody romping on those Saturday night functions back at the Cotton Club. And this is called Miss the Saturday Dance. I heard they crowded the floor, but I wouldn't have gone in without you. Don't get around much anymore. Thought I'd visit the club. I got as far as the door. Oh, darling, I'm lonesome without you. Don't get around much anymore. Sweetheart, I guess my mind's more at ease. But nevertheless, oh, why bring back memories? Been invited on dates. Could have gone, but what for? I'm lonesome without you. Don't little around my damn anymore, yeah.
been invited on dates. I could have gone, but what for? I'm so lonesome without you. I'm so depressed without you. Oh, don't get around much anymore. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Next time, Harry Connick Jr. plays music by Harold Arlen. From Connick's first album on Columbia Records, Harry Connick Jr., here's part of an original composition called E. This is Fresh Air. So far, other singers have had more luck recording the songs of Jules Scheer than he has. Cyndi Lauper scored a hit with his song All Through the Night, and the Bangles made it to the charts with If She Knew What She Wants. Both songs started out on solo albums by Scheer. Before his solo album, Scheer recorded with the groups Funky Kings and Jules and the Polar Bears. Scheer is singing his songs with a new group he formed called Restless Sleepers. Their new album is called Big Boss Sounds, and from it, here's If We Never Meet Again.
I know how just one smile can be planted like a seed, and I wanna do that for somebody else the way it was done for me. I wanna have a little faith. There's something better at the end of this path, 'cause these memories can only flat like photographs.
I like your singing, but I have to say you don't have a typical lead singer's voice.
Oh, thank goodness.
Why did you say thank goodness?
Well, you know, I don't know. I guess I've always liked people. When I was growing up, I always liked people who sang with their very natural, whatever was their natural way to sing. They didn't try to adapt themselves to, like, the way people are supposed to sound by someone else's rules. And generally, this meant that, like, most of these people were songwriters that appealed to me, and they were singing songs that they wrote in a way that they felt would communicate. And the thing is to get across the feeling that is integral to the song, I guess.
You know, sometimes you really strain to reach the high notes in a song that you're singing, mm-hmm. and I think it adds an emotional tug to the song. And it reminds me even of, I know, like at Motown Records, they would frequently record the singers in a slightly higher key than they were capable of singing in, because it gave, that reaching for the high note gave the singing urgency.
I like that myself. I mean, I could easily drop things down a couple keys and then not have to do that. But I always end up writing things like that because, it feels good when you're singing it to really feel like you're working when you go for those notes. And I think that if that's a feeling that you want to get over to a listener, that's a really good way to do it. It's not really so good if it makes the listener feel so uncomfortable that they just want to be removed from that immediately. But I've never had a problem with it in other singers. I kind of like that feeling myself, and so I do go for that.
Mm-hmm. How did your song start getting recorded by others?
Well, I guess it was just by stumbling on to people, or people stumbling on to me. It was, you know, like I was in bands in Los Angeles, and I was in a band that made an obscure sort of record called Funky Kings, and like Olivia Newton-John heard the record and recorded a song that I wrote on that record. That got things going. Somebody who was a mutual friend between me and Art Garfunkel gave him a song of mine. Art recorded this song. People began to like pay attention to me as a songwriter instead of being in a band. But my songs have always been not the most recordable by other people. Every once in a while, I seem to write something where someone grabs onto it and says, "Yeah, this will be great for me." But for the most part, my songs are either like too personal or considered to be maybe too left field or something to be recorded by people, but that doesn't deter me from writing them.
Well, I know you divide your songs into the commercial and non-commercial categories. What are the differences between the two?
You know, I to tell you the truth, I divide them between those two categories only really after the fact.
You mean the ones that sold and the ones that didn't?
Those are the ones that are commercial, that's right.
So you can't tell what's
going
to work
can't.
Commercially?
I really sat down. I was in London once, and I was with some friends of mine. We sat, and they all went out to have a bunch of fun. I was feeling guilty because I hadn't been writing songs. So I sat down and thought, I'm going to write a song today. So I sat down and wrote this little folk song. I mean, it was a song called All Through the Night that Cyndi Lauper recorded, had a top five record with. Now, see, I'd have never been able to know that that would be the song that somebody would have picked to have a big hit with. To me, it was like a folk song, you know, and my point is, I'm pretty terrible at choosing which ones might be successful.
You have a whole album of demos. Demos are demonstration records that a songwriter uses to show a potential performer how the song should sound. How do you use demos? Do you just make a demo of every song you write?
I'd like to. It's fun to make demos. The great thing about making demos is it's sort of like making records, only you make them really fast, and there's very, very little pressure because you're not going to put them out for sale.
They could be rough.
They can be as rough as you like. Sometimes it's even good if they're rough. I mean, a lot of songwriters have theories about this. They're like, if you make a demo and it sounds too good, that like people won't be able to like a singer who gets it won't be able to interpret it for himself. They'll just go, well, that's the way it is. But if you make it rough, they think, well, if only this was really polished, it would be really fantastic, and they're more likely to record it. I don't know about these things. I make them rough because it's fun, because that's 'cause I like music to be a little on the rough side.
I think it's really interesting to compare your demo recording of All Through the Night and Cyndi Lauper's recording of it, and she had a big hit mm-hmm. with it and made it to the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
Your recording of it is, you know, rough, straightforward. I'm not sure what word to use.
It's folky, I guess.
Yeah.
Hers is sort of more Euro pop, I guess
yeah.
you'd say, with
yeah.
sequencers and stuff like that. I had like an acoustic guitar chugging along and just sort of laid the song down that way.
Oh, all through the
Did it change the song for you at all, hearing the Cyndi Lauper version?
Well, let me see. I sang all the background vocals on Cyndi's
really?
Version. Yeah, so it was no real big shock to me.
Right.
I heard it while they were recording it, and I sang all the background vocals, and so I knew exactly what it was going to be when it came out.
Now, the Bangles had a hit of your song, If She Knew What She Wants.
Yeah.
Now, when you sing it, you say the lyric is, if she knew what she wants, I'd be giving it to her. When the Bangles sing it, it's if she knew what she wants, he'd be giving it to her.
Yeah, I know. Well, they have to figure out what to do with that. I don't know.
I think think it makes it more ironic when they sing it. It's like, well, he said he's trying.
Yeah, I guess that's it. I guess that's it. I thought that was kind of strange, and I wondered when I heard they were recording the song. I thought, how are they going to do that? You know, how are they going to change the genders? They managed. They did it. If she knew what she wants.
The last few albums have been solo. Why did you want to be part of a band again?
Well, I really missed being in a band, first of all. I think it's really fun to be in a group and to be around like-minded musicians. And I was writing a lot of songs alone by myself, like at home, just sitting there with an acoustic guitar. And I had just done so much of it. And I'd been co-writing sometimes with other people, but I really wanted a stable sort of group of people that could make up music together. So I wasn't looking for a band simply to play with. I wanted a group that would also make up the songs. We could actually be musically creative together. That's what I was trying to do, is find the sort of musical camaraderie and get that happening.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for doing this.
Jules Shear and his group Restless Sleepers have a new album on IRS Records called Big Boss Sounds. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. How are you?
What's your big campaign story of the day?
Well, we have a report from the Bush campaign where earlier in the day there were expectations that the attacks on Dukakis would be toned down, but then by a later appearance they were back in full swing again. Also, we hear from Linda Wertheimer with the Dukakis campaign about how they're coping with the blues on the Democratic side, and a report by Cokie Roberts on the Senate race in the state of Connecticut. The incumbent Republican, maverick liberal Republican Lowell Weicker, is being challenged by the state's Attorney General, Joe Lieberman, and it's turned into something of a race.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you're tired of seeing one-dimensional, vapid roles for women on the screen, critic at large Laurie Stone says stay home and tune into some new TV programs that feature women who can think on their feet.
In movies today, if a female character works and savors independence, she'll likely be taken down a peg or transformed into a self-denier. See Die Hard, where corporate exec Bonnie Bedelia apologizes for her work life by going back to her husband's last name. And in Punchline, Sally Field, who has wanted to be a stand-up comedian more than anything else in life, surrenders her shot on Carson to her male competitor. Films are largely geared toward men. Men go to more movies than women. But the audience for TV has a higher percentage of women, and on the tube, on shows like L.A. Law and Hooperman, independent, coherent females can still be spotted. This season, strong-minded women propel a trio of sitcoms, ABC's Roseanne, NBC's Baby Boom, and CBS's Murphy Brown. Based on the pilots, the shows aren't equally amusing, but in all, the central female mind is sharper than its surroundings. The much-touted Roseanne seems the slightest, although it offers the rare portrayal of a blue-collar family whose house isn't neat. To Roseanne's husband, pouring cereal is helping with the housework. He's a fourth child, and unfortunately, we're supposed to like Roseanne, who has a full-time job, because she tolerates his fecklessness. Sentimentality is the price she pays for her smart mouth. In a typical crack, she says, she doesn't worry about birth control. Before going to bed, she just spends an hour with her kids. The show is mechanical, but on the plus side, Roseanne doesn't sanctify domesticity, and Barr is appealingly unapologetic about her hefty poundage. In Baby Boom, the movie, Diane Keaton was pilloried for her ambitiousness, but Baby Boom, the TV show, likes its Tiger Lady, played by Kate Jackson. From billowy comforters to Milan clothes, the show arouses hunger for material cushiness. But crackling-voiced Jackson doesn't come across as spoiled or self-pitying, but rather as a woman torn by competing responsibilities. Instead of making the single working woman a case, Baby Boom lampoons housebound compulsives. At a mom support group, one woman, whose eyes are blinking nervously, psychobabbles, "I've resolved my problems about not working and staying home." Jackson's job isn't a safe haven, though. Now that she has a baby, her mistrustful boss sicks her with a young male assistant. "It's a pleasure to work with a single mom not obsessed with her biological clock," smarms the barracuda in Armani clothing. The dynamic is promising. Even more so is Murphy Brown, starring Candace Bergen as a leathery media jock in love with the 60s. The show is chocked with witty, timely details. Bergen, the star of a show like 60 Minutes, has just returned from the Betty Ford Clinic, where she's kicked all addictive substances. Nervous as a cat in her office, she keeps sniffing a pack of cigarettes, and when she barks out a question about the whereabouts of her secretary, she learns the employee has left to sell Herbalife. Murphy Brown is as yupscale as Baby Boom. Refreshingly, though, neurosis is allowed to linger in trouble rather than being instantly drained of threat. On first taste, Roseanne, Baby Boom, and Murphy Brown go down like seltzer, cutting against the sexism of the Reagan years and the treacly domestic pieties of 30-something and its spawn.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with actor Peter Scolari. He plays the self-absorbed super yup Michael Harris on the TV series Newhart. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review a new reissue featuring singer Dinah Washington as recorded in the early 50s. And TV critic David Bianculli will review the new Mission Impossible, starring Peter Graves once again as Impossible Mission Force mastermind Jim Phelps. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Fred Landerl, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.